Welcome to Farmscape Online. I'm Bruce Cochran. My guest is Dr. John Harding, a professor in the Department of Large Animal Clinical Sciences with the University of Saskatchewan's Western College of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Harding.
Thank you. My pleasure, Bruce.
Scientists with the University of Saskatchewan's Western College of Veterinary Medicine are working to reduce the threat to pigs posed by porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, or PRRS. First of all, what is PRRS? What are the clinical signs of this infection, and how widespread is it?
Bruce, PRRS is one of the most important diseases globally affecting the pig population, and it's endemic in many countries, including Canada, and it's an exceptionally costly disease to the industry. So there's two forms, as the name suggests. There's the reproductive form that causes disease in late gestation of pregnant females, abortions, fetal death. If fetuses do survive after infection, then they're weak at birth. And usually we have a fairly high pre-mortality rate in those pigs. The second form of the disease is respiratory in nature. It affects really any age of pig after birth, so in nursery, grow, finish, causing pneumonia, as well as a very profound immunosuppression, which leads to secondary infections.
How many different strains of PRRS are we aware of? How pathogenic are those strains? How does that pathogenicity vary from strain to strain, and what's the significance of that variation?
Yeah, those are very good questions. Firstly, you know, there are thousands of different strains of PRRS around the world and in any individual country. Globally, they're broken up into two major genotypes, which now actually we consider separate species of the virus. Genotype 1 or species 1 is largely present in the European Union, East and West, and genotype 2 or species 2 is really present around the rest of the world, but I guess its heritage is really back in the U.S., and that's what we deal with here in Canada and in the U.S. is these PRRS2 strains. They vary in pathogenicity. They can be everything from mild, subclinical, or even aclinical at times to the exact opposite, where they're causing very, very severe both respiratory and reproductive infections. So it really just depends on the strains you're dealing with. We tend to see hot strains in various regions that seem to circulate, and then for some reason some of them disappear and new strains emerge.
What specifically are researchers looking at with regards to this virus, and why, and what are the challenges?
Yeah, so we've been working here at the University of Saskatchewan since 2012 on the reproductive form of the disease. You know, it's a very challenging experimental model. Reproduction, or with a reproductive form, you need, you know, pregnant animals, which are expensive to purchase, take a lot of human resources to get to the stage where they're susceptible, and you're dealing with big animals, and nobody seems to really want to do a lot of work on fetuses. But we took up the challenge because of our interest and our expertise here. So we've really been investigating why fetuses die, because that really is unknown. And also, what's I think more interesting for the producer's standpoint is why some fetuses don't die and why are they resilient? And we really ultimately hope to find new tools and strategies to control PRRS that can be used in addition to the available vaccines and other forms of intervention. You know, what we feel is that, you know, vaccines have their place and in times are very successful, other times less successful. But moving forward, this is a very smart and simple virus that mutates readily, and it will take more than simply vaccines to control this in the long term.
How is and how has information been gathered, from where and how is the data being assessed and analyzed?
So we've performed a series of experiments, and we call them the Pregnant Guilt Model Experiments, or PGM. And essentially what this involves is purchasing a pregnant gilt, and we're using a purebred Landrace that is bred to a yard, large white or Yorkshire, so that the progeny are F1s. We purchase them in third trimester and inoculate them with a fairly virulent or pathogenic strain of type 2 PRRS at about 85 days of gestation. And then we sacrifice both the dam and the litter, depending on the experiment, 2 to 3 weeks later. Then those animals brought into necropsy, and we do complete dissection on the dam and all the fetuses. And it's really the gathering of those tissues and blood across multiple time points, sometimes depending on the experiment or just at termination. But those fetal tissues and blood are used then for subsequent laboratory investigations. And that could be with respect to the virus or how the virus is interacting with the uterus and placenta or in the fetus. Or it could be studies of immunology or studies of just mechanisms of disease, more along the lines of physiology. Or we have done some that are strictly related to genetics as well, to try to see if there are genetic markers that are involved in susceptibility to PRRS. And all this work is being done, you know, based out of Saskatchewan here. We do the animal care work and the necropsy and the tissue collection. But a lot of the analysis and the subsequent laboratory work has been done by our collaborators, both the University of Alberta, the USDA in Maryland, as well as a collaborator, former colleague of mine in Vienna, which are kind of all doing different things, but collectively we pool our data together to learn and try to make decisions on how best to move forward.
What key lessons have been learned so far, and what have been the factors there that have contributed to that?
Yeah, there's lots of really exciting stuff that we have learned, and we're really starting from the point of not knowing very much about PRRS at all. That there is a wave of research done on the reproductive model back in the early 90s, early to mid 90s, both in Europe and the USA, when the virus was first discovered, and then not a lot got done until we got started here about 20 years after that. So we are looking specifically at resilience. You know, that's our goal. How can we make litters more resilient to PRRS? And that's, you know, looking at it from the point of view of if a sow was to become infected, how can we get that sow or that gilt to deliver a healthy litter, or as healthy as possible? The virus will always likely cross the placenta. We're not going to block it completely. But if we can find ways to make the litter or the individual fetuses more resilient, that's going to be a benefit to everybody. So what that means to us is we want to have a live fetus as opposed to a dead fetus. And we want to have a fetus with low level of infection or low viral load when it is born. And in our experimental model, we see resilience, or let's say fetal mortality rates, range from 0 to 100% across individual animals. So we know that there are some resilient gilts, you know, that do not shed to their litter for some reason. And we know that there are lots of individual fetuses that can resist infection for greater periods of time than their litter mates. And then there is the other extreme as well, where you have very, very susceptible sows and very, very susceptible fetuses. So that's what we're trying to figure out. And we have learned a bunch of stuff that's leading toward that. And, you know, one of the things we would look at initially was, if we have resilience, is that because the dam is resilient, or is that because there are things at the barrier of the placental barrier that determine resilience, or is it things happening in the fetus that determine resilience? And in the long run, it's probably all three, but we really are focusing now in on events that are happening at the placental barrier, and we call that the maternal fetal interface, as well as events that are happening in the fetus. And that's been a novel step forward, because previous research suggested that the fetus dies because the placenta separates, and we do not believe that's really the reason that fetuses die. they clearly respond to infection. So we really are focused on now the fetus and the uterus. We know that the virus crosses the placental barrier very, very quickly, within 2 days of infection. We know that the virus can make its way into the cell type that comprise the uterus. Those are little epithelial cells, where that's not been known before. It doesn't seem to replicate in those cells, but it certainly gets in, and if it can get in, it probably can get out as well. So it means the virus actually transits right through those cells. We know, and we've learned and repeated in several experiments, that big fetuses are more susceptible than small fetuses. So those small little tiny runt fetuses that have gone through intrauterine growth retardation are in fact more resistant or more resilient to PRRS than the big healthy fetuses that we think are the good ones that we want all the time. We know that death clusters in litters, so that means that there's something happening in areas of the uterus that make that group of fetuses more prone. We know that the fetus responds to infection. It has cytokine release. We have evidence of cell death and evidence of hypoxia now, and that's very novel, because before people thought, you know, the death was caused by placental separation, but it's clearly there's activity happening when the virus infects the fetus. And then some of the most exciting work we've looked at is looking at genetic markers which code for resilience. And there's one particular marker, one SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism, that we found through our collaboration with University of Alberta on the seventh chromosome, which is very exciting. And we spent some time now the last year or so looking specifically on that, you know, genetic marker and why, or I guess why it would be potentially coding for resilience, and if it, you know, truly is a good marker that we can use going forward.
How will the information gathered through this work be applied? By whom? And what are the anticipated benefits of this application?
Yeah, so this is a long-term project, you know, research projects. You know, some research projects you get low-hanging fruit that you can bring back to producers within a couple of months. This one is much longer term than that. PRRS is a big disease. PRRS will not be solved in the next couple of months. So we're looking in a time frame of probably 3 to 4 years to get something back to the industry. And really, I think the best lead that we have now as far as the application aspect of this work would be finding a genetic marker that codes for resilience. And I won't say that we're really close to that, but we're getting a lot closer to that. We have got additional funding now, and we have got this single nucleotide polymorphism that's of interest, and we're now working on mechanisms, and this additional funding we've got just recently will help us go out and find the gene. So I guess my happy day would be to bring back to the industry a genetic test that we can use at the nucleus level in breeding companies to find animals that are more resilient based on the presence or absence of one or more genes that we feel is part of the pathogenesis of PRRS. And that's really similar to what's been done on the respiratory side with the WR SNP that was found on the fourth chromosome related to average daily gain and viral load in the respiratory pig model.
What are the anticipated time frames for this work?
Yeah, well, I think we're making, you know, good progress in terms of research. So I would hope that in the next, you know, 1 to 2 years, we would have mechanisms sorted out to know whether it's worth proceeding into industry application. And if we do have some positive results, and we're probably looking at 3 to 4 years to get something into the hands of industry that they can start to at least investigate. Wouldn't say that they're going to apply it right away, but they would do their internal investigations and then hopefully apply later if they find that there's something positive to latch on to.
And is there anything you would like to add?
Yeah, I think we have to just keep in mind that PRRS is still a very fundamental disease in the industry. It tends to get lost in the excitement of the day, and you know, there's lots of talk about PED and ASF, which are obviously very important diseases as well. But PRRS is there underlying, and it's not going to go anytime go away anytime soon. So hope to have, you know, tools in place that we can increase resilience in the future. And that would help, you know, producers increase productivity, reduce losses, improve welfare. And all of that, I think, is very much possible. And I think our funders have been incredibly supportive over the years. Most of this work has been funded by Genome Canada, Genome Prairie, and Genome Alberta, and the associated provincial governments of Saskatchewan and Alberta. We're very thankful for their support. So hopefully we can talk in the future about what we've accomplished and how it's being used in the industry.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce.
Our guest has been Dr. John Harding, a professor in the Department of Large Animal Clinical Sciences with the University of Saskatchewan's Western College of Veterinary Medicine. For Farmscape Online, I'm Bruce Cochran.